welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Today happens to be World Mental Health Day. It's the 10th year that it's being celebrated worldwide. According to the World Health Organization, one in four people in the world are affected by mental or neurological disorders at some point in their lives. Around 450 million people currently suffer from mental health conditions. While mental health remains a worldwide issue, the mental health crisis unfolding right here in the Bay Area is presenting a major challenge. Earlier this week, the California Peer Run Warm Line officially opened to the public. It's a service that offers free non-emergency emotional support, and it offers referrals to anyone in the state who is able to call in or instant message. The Warm Line is staffed by peers who are counselors and staff who have themselves experienced mental health challenges. The service was made possible through California funding a $10.8 million budget allocation. It took 3 years to get it done. It was spearheaded by Governor Gavin Newsom. Coming next month, the Mental Health Association of San Francisco will actually be hosting its own annual conference. This year, it's called Redefining Crazy. It's the system, not the people. That in of itself is a provocative title. It's designed to get people talking. The conference will bring together peers, advocates, providers, tech developers, and government leaders to analyze our mental health system and hopefully come up with some real solutions. So it's very timely that we have three studio guests today, all of them associated with the MHASF, that's the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. Welcome, Lisa Sun Grisham.
Welcome. Hi.
Lisa, you joined the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. You were a triage peer provider on the Marin Crisis Continuum team at Marin General Hospital. And Lisa is currently the programs manager for a team of dedicated peer coaches who provide one-on-one support and wellness experiences and drop-in support groups. And you co-facilitate mental health trainings and wrap groups for community-based organizations. You've worked with the High Rocks Educational Corporation. That's a leadership and empowerment organization for young girls in West Virginia. Lisa Sun Grisham, thank you so much for braving the traffic and power shutdowns and all the rest to be here in studio with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You bet. Peter Murphy is here as well. Peter is a native San Franciscan who's lived extensively as a consumer himself of mental health services. Peter has been an active member of the 12-step recovery movement in San Francisco for the past quarter century, and he identifies as having substance abuse issues. His mental health and substance abuse challenges have taken him to emergency rooms and psych wards and jails. Peter has worked at the Mental Health Association of San Francisco since the start of 2015 as a supervisor and counselor on the San Francisco Peer Run Warm Line for nearly 4 years. And for the past year, Peter has been with the Outreach Manager, Manager's Office at the MHASF. And in that capacity, Peter has established really important relationships with a network of community-based organizations all across the Bay Area. So, Peter, your input is so valuable. Thank you for being here today as well.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
And rounding out the trio, Mark Salazar. Mark became the executive director of the Mental Health Association of San Francisco just over a year ago in July of 2018. Mark was the associate director and oversaw the MHASF's peer support and recovery workforce development departments, and that actually included the Peer Run Warm Line and clinically integrated peer services. So, Mark, thank you so much for being here as well.
Thank you for having us.
You know, this is one of those subjects that everyone is touched by in one way or another. So really early on in the conversation, I want to just send out a call to those who are listening who may have their questions about mental health treatment, outreach, whether you're suffering yourself or you know or love someone. Please join the conversation. The phone call is 866-798-8255, or you can drop us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. I'm so glad you could all join us on what turned out to be World Mental Health Day. Just kind of worked out that way. But let's start with you, Lisa. What do you think is the biggest challenge in talking about and treating mental illness today?
So the biggest challenge about talking about mental illness, mm-hmm. stigma, mm-hmm. the negative belief about a group of people. And that can be internalized stigma, messages that we've taken on and decided that that's sort of an aspect of self. Or also the stigma that you sometimes receive when you're just trying to access resources and just trying to engage in the public mental health system. Preconceived notions about why you're there or what's wrong with you from service providers. So when I think about language and the language that we choose to use to talk about mental health challenges, we really need to start dismantling it from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I thought the name of this conference, Redefining Crazy. Hopefully, I'm sure the idea of calling it that was to take away some of the sting and the stigma and redefine what that word means and take it back, literally take it back and redefine what it means.
Absolutely. And because typically you think that it's within just the person, like you said, that the person themselves is the source of the craziness. And we sort of postulate, let's take a look at the actual system of public mental health care and see where we can improve all of the different cogs so that people not only have access, but they have equitable access and receive respectful, compassionate treatment across the entire process from A to Z.
Mm-hmm. Well, I happen to be of the opinion that we are all somewhere on that spectrum. And if not in a constant state, then perhaps in an acute way, based on what might be happening in our lives, the loss of a loved one or a divorce or some other life-changing situation, I think we're all on that spectrum. And Peter, you can speak firsthand about how you have dealt with this in your life.
Definitely, yeah. I think for myself, I was really in denial around a lot of the issues that I had. I mean, I did get clean and sober quite a while ago, and I felt like, and I had mental health challenges all along as well. And I think for a long time I was kind of treating them separately, mm-hmm. like, all right, I'll address my alcohol and drug problems, and then this other aspect of my life will take care of itself, or it's not that bad, or whatever. And I feel like I learned the hard way that I needed to really treat my mental health and my substance use issues as one thing and not separate them. I have a kind of a family history where there's issues with both areas. And like Lisa's son mentioned, I feel like I had a lot of internal stigma, you know, where it would be like I was willing to accept help around substance use and alcoholism. But with my mental health, it was like, well, I'm going to figure this out and it's going to be okay. And what would happen is I might do pretty well for a while, and then I would get into a crisis, maybe take some medication, see a therapist. Then I'd start to feel better, and then I'd stop the treatment, thinking, well, I guess I'm okay now. And then this was like a cycle that I repeated many times.
I'm sure you've heard that story over yeah. and over, thousands and yeah. thousands and thousands of times. Isn't that exactly the way it works?
I think for a lot of people, mm-hmm. yeah. And so I really learned the hard way, I feel like, that I had to consistently pay attention to my mental health as well.
Well, that really gives value to your peer-to-peer approach. When you speak to someone, you can tell them, I know whereof I speak. I know where you are. How valuable is that?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the Pure Run Warm Lane that you described earlier, that's a lot of times I think maybe the most important thing that we can provide is that there's hope of recovery and that we can demonstrate some of that. It's, you know, we don't feel like, I mean, I certainly don't feel like I've graduated into now everything's fine, but it's kind of an ongoing challenge to just to pay attention to both the issues I've had with substances and my mental health. And that's what a lot of the times that's what we'll share as fundamental as that on our phone line. Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I give the phone number?
No, the more often you can do it during this hour, the better. Go
yeah.
right ahead.
Yeah. So, as, Renee mentioned, we're actually on Monday, we just, had the official launch of the California Pure Run Warm Line. It kind of has a bit of a long history in a way, but so it's officially launched as of Monday that we'll be taking calls from the whole state of California. Mm-hmm. Our hours currently are Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., and Saturday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., and then Sunday from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., with the idea that eventually, in the next few months, it'll be a 24/7 service. And the phone number is 1-855-845-7415.
And we'll be giving that number out several more times.
Great.
And it'll be on the KALW website as well. That really was some really good news, Mark, the California Peer Run Warm Line. And, I mean, you got to like that name, right? It's the Warm Line. The call center is going to be ramped up now 24/7. Is it officially 24/7?
No, not yet. We'll have it ready hopefully by the end of the year.
Okay. And you're expecting about 25,000 calls per year.
That's what we're expecting. And that's unlimited hours. So prior to these statistics, we had limited hours on the warm line as well for San Francisco Bay Area. And we did receive that much calls. And so if we expand 24/7 and officially taking calls from the entire state, we expect way more than 25,000 calls.
That was my thinking, yeah. Too. I thought that might be the way it starts, but I have a hunch the need is really great.
Yeah, I mean, from what we've known since the press release on Monday and the conference and all the conversations we've been having, there's calls every minute or so, and everybody who wants, you know, every caller that gets off the phone, somebody picks up 30 seconds later. It's mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of instant messages, and so we are like over capacity at this point, and so you know, we're working to ramp it up as fast as we can so that, you know, people don't feel like we're ignoring them or anything like that.
Well, it's good news and bad news,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. This initiative is actually piggybacking off of San Francisco's Peer Run Warm Line, and that opened about 5 years ago back in 2014, yes?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we opened with the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
How important was it to expand that initiative, and what are the goals of the new service?
So it was very important to expand because we did get a lot of calls from California. And unfortunately, when we get calls outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, we had to turn people off. We were like, hey, you know, we can only limit you to maybe one or two calls a day and all that stuff. And that was really challenging for us to hear somebody like, hey, I want to call more than a few times a day. And we're like, yeah, definitely. And that's something we made a priority for ourselves. We want to make sure that you get listened to before, you know, you get into any type of hotline crisis that we like to say.
Mm-hmm. And this is peer-to-peer. So how does that approach differ from, say, a normal regular hotline or helpline?
Yeah, so the peer-to-peer model is the fact that the person that takes the call actually has gone through the same kind of emotional challenges and mental health challenges that caller has. Mm-hmm. So they have that compassion and that empathy and that ability to step in that person's shoes and to kind of really understand what they're going through. A lot of us, you know, never really go through that, but peers really can understand it and really have gone through the same exact thing.
And is the idea to avoid people going to the emergency room or having some kind of a police intervention?
That's the whole idea of a warm line. You know, like we call it, like, you know, when you boil a pot of water, mm-hmm. A warm line, you know, it's just simmering. We try and prevent it from boiling over into a hotline. And so preventing that is actually a very beneficial thing for both the individual and the community itself.
It seems kind of like almost like a no-brainer. You know, you figure if you can get people to talk to folks who can relate, who are actually have the benefit of having lived through and can talk about having come out the other side, it seems like, is there a paradigm elsewhere where this is working? Peter, have you looked at other cities and municipalities that have taken this approach successfully?
Definitely. Before I started on the Warm Line in 2015, I started pretty soon after the Warm Line began. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very familiar. I'd heard of Warm Lines a little bit, but there really is a kind of a culture of this, and also peer recovery, which it's a product of, and peer recovery is a principle of how the Warm Line works. There's a culture of that, I'd say, all over the country. It's stronger in certain areas. I know the Oregon Warm Line is pretty strong. And when we were trying to develop the funding for the California Peer Run Warm Line, we looked at some of those other models as well. It's our understanding that the California line is the first statewide line that's been sponsored by a state. A lot of times, actually, the warm lines that we have in other areas are they're a little bit, they're usually smaller, maybe a volunteer run. Which is, it's great that people want to help like that. I've heard a lot of stories of, you know, where it's like, hey, the phone's over there, you know, go for it, you know, which I'm saying that because it really puts the counselors out there into a position where they can't be as helpful or they might have a hard time taking care of themselves as well. So I think one thing that's great about our program is that we have really great training built into it and also a lot of supervision so that the counselors who, you know, we've talked about their peers as well, meaning they have their own challenges so that they don't get triggered by calls. I mean, that happens sometimes anyway, but we try to minimize it and also just address it with the idea that this is going to happen. So
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, in my experience, you kind of never know what's going to trigger you exactly. I mean, some things make sense, but actually I had a few calls where it might even just be the sound of a person's voice, you know, that would remind me, say, of somebody important to me. Mm-hmm. And so you couldn't really, you know, it might not be even the content of the call. But and I feel like being on the warm line, the idea of that we need to care for ourselves. And we see it as a real community that includes the callers and the counselors so that we're all, like, part of the same community. I've learned a lot from the callers. You know, the callers will call in with resources that I haven't thought of myself or, you know, that I'm not aware of. And that's one of those things about, I think, being on the phone line that, you know, it's priceless. You know, I mean, you really feel like in a lot of ways you're helping others and they're helping you too.
Yeah, if it's okay, I want to stick with you for just a bit about how where in your development you felt like you could reach out. I'm wondering if that was something that it took you a while to get to. So by the time someone's ready to pick up the phone and get that kind of peer-to-peer support, how much are they likely to have already been through and suffered, and how many attempts to get better are people likely to have had before they reach out to a situation like the peer-to-peer?
That's a really good question. I mean, I feel like for myself, I mean, I'm not the oldest person, I think, that's worked on the warm line, but I'm one of the older people. And so I sometimes would jokingly say it's taken me like many years of attempts and progress and then steps backwards to be kind of where I'm at now and to be able to offer the service and to be part of it. I'm really impressed with some of the younger folks that we have that it seems like they have found recovery around their mental health and are able to share that recovery with others a lot sooner than I was able to. Mm-hmm. And I think if I'm hearing your question right, also, you know, when is somebody, like, say somebody listening to us today, when would they be ready maybe to pick up the phone, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I just, I know what it's like. I mean, I've had those days where you can't get out of bed, you know, you can't make it to the door, you can't take a shower, you don't want to eat. And sometimes when people call in, I feel like, again, we're trying to provide some hope. And sometimes I'll say to them, hey, you know, it's great you called into us today. That's really great, because there's people that don't know about us that aren't going to call in, and there's also people that are just going to be so, like, without hope, hopeless, that, or for whatever reason, not able to call in.
Yeah, they know you're there. They're just not there yet.
Yeah. And it's really different for everyone, you know, like even with the referrals. I mean, we go out into – right now I go out into the community a lot, and I talk to community organizations, and, you know – a lot of the organizations, I think, are great. And, you know, you might talk to somebody about a resource like 10 times and say, hey, you should do this. Like even the warm line, let's say. And then perhaps when they call us, you know, it's that 11th time of hearing whatever it is, you know, that they say, yeah, I think I'll try that, you know. And you just don't know. You know, we call it the stages of change and like the how people grow like that. I mean, I think when somebody – and I don't want to get too far off topic at all, but, you know, like even like somebody that's trying to quit smoking cigarettes, they say, I think it takes like 10 or 13 times of like, all right, I'm trying, I relapsed. And I think with alcoholism, with drugs, very few people, you know, find recovery just instantly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a process.
Yeah, my guess too is that part of the difficulty in getting people to reach out for this kind of help is that part of the problem is inertia. So when you're depressed or you have anxiety or you're in the midst of a really serious downtime, it's hard to move. It's hard to get off the couch, let alone walk across the room, pick up the phone, and start talking through it. So, Lisa, you can talk, I imagine, about the extent to which outreach is great if you can get people to reach out.
Mm-hmm. So what exactly is your question?
I guess the challenge of having a peer-to-peer approach is that there are people waiting to help if you can get the people who need the help to actually reach out to get it. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that? Is it billboards? Is it just being ubiquitous, letting people know in every possible way that the help is there and just wait for them to get to the point where they can reach out?
I think part of it is that ubiquitousness, like flash flooding people with the, mm-hmm. the knowledge that it's available. I can speak for my own self. When I carry a diagnosis of PTSD, and I had a few years ago, I had a recurrence. Really, really strong flashbacks came back to me as I was doing my graduate education, getting my master's in counseling psychology, drama therapy. So a lot of psycho's analytical stuff was coming up for me. And so I went to go get therapy through Kaiser. And it was one of those situations where I knew I wanted to see my therapist at least once a week. But Kaiser was so overloaded. When I spoke to my provider, she said, I can't possibly do that for you. I can do maybe 6 weeks or 8 weeks from now.
Wow.
And I said, this is sort of unacceptable. Not only am I in a master's program to become a counseling psychologist, but I can't get the services that I need for my own mental health support so that I can get the education so that I can then serve mm-hmm. my community. And I had been kind of wishing, and I thought, gosh, I wish there was something somewhere I could call or talk to, because really I just wanted someone to chat with for maybe an hour every week to talk about how difficult things were or what was coming up for me that wasn't my friends or family, because sometimes they hear a lot of that, and it's nice to have someone who's not only going to create a safe container for you to be your full whole authentic self, but they don't have any like stake in the game, right? So they just go, I'm here for you. Mm-hmm. I'm making this safe container for you. I don't have a invested interest in what you choose to do. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to tell you do this, do that, do this. It's not about advice giving. It's about, may I share this with you? This part of my story I think might be helpful for you. Is that all right? And you invite the connection and the warmth between two people. So it's also a different power hierarchy between peer mutual support and the classic sort of medical model that we get taught in school.
And it really is peer to peer. It isn't that hierarchy, the white coat syndrome and all mm-hmm. of that. And having your own firsthand experience, I didn't realize that you had an issue around PTSD. Mm-hmm. I see you have an emotional support dog that you brought with you. Who's with you today?
His name is Lore. He's mm-hmm. a Cardigan Welsh Corgi, and he's sleeping at the moment.
And it's a wonderful thing. There's so many approaches to trying to get mental health assistance. But like you said, I'd like to talk a bit more about some of the barriers that exist. So hope you'll stay with us. It's Your Call.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is your call. Hope you'll join us tomorrow for the Friday Media Roundtable. Lots to get to in the news. We'll have a roundtable of journalists discussing the Supreme Court cases that are so important and pending. Also, impeachment and where that stands, and the Turkish invasion of northern Syria and all of the implications of that. That's on tomorrow's Your Call. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org and listen to past shows there and sign up for the newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And we love your show ideas. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're talking about mental health. It's coinciding with World Mental Health Day, and we are joined by members of the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. They're putting on a conference next month. It's called Redefining Crazy. It's the system, not the people. I love that title. That conference will be taking place on November 6th and 7th at Bespoke. That's at 845 Market Street in San Francisco. You can find out more information about the event on our website. And you can join our conversation right now, 866-798-8255 is the number. If you or someone you know or love is actually dealing with mental health issues, you know, we in San Francisco don't have to go far to see people who are clearly suffering from mental health conditions. Schizophrenia, for example, is just, it seems to be so prevalent now. It's on the streets of our city. So let's learn some quick facts about where our mental health care system is here in San Francisco. According to a recent report from the Board of Supervisors, Budget and Legislative Analysts, the number of so-called subacute mental health care beds fell by a third in the 5 years between 2013 and 2018. That just seems to be terribly ill-timed at a time when the need is greater than ever, and that left only 241 treatment spots available in a city the size of San Francisco. Also, the number of conservatorship referrals in San Francisco dropped by almost half between 2012 and this year. So let's start by explaining what conservatorship is. Mark Salazar, can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, conservatorship is when a public official, probably a medical professional, or it could be even be a law enforcement officer, when they deem someone is not capable of caring for themselves, so they would initiate a conservatorship where the person would be taken involuntarily to receive services in a facility, locked facility at that.
So it's a public official that makes the determination?
Not necessarily public. It could be their physician. It could be their psychiatrist, psychologist. It could be a police officer. So the new law, the SB 1040 law that, you know, the Board of Supervisors passed recently, they kind of can force anybody arbitrarily to our understanding to receive, to be conserved, basically. And the arbitrary number, I believe, is 8 police incidents. So there is no, like, studies tied to it. It's just an arbitrary number of, you've been talked to by the police officers about 8 times.
Yeah, why 8? Why not 5?
Why not 5? Why not 3? Why not 10? Why not 20? It could be unlimited. Mm-hmm. But it was an arbitrary number that we believe that they take someone's civil rights away from them involuntarily, and they just lock them up and force treatment upon them. And there are Supreme Court laws that have dictated that you can't just do that to somebody.
Well, it's back on the local radar, that whole issue. Just this week, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that San Francisco Mayor London Breed is planning to expand San Francisco's conservatorship program. So I'll throw this out to all three of you to weigh in. Mark, you were already going down that road. So what are your thoughts? I think I got a hint, but what are your thoughts about the city's approach to stepping this up?
Yeah, I mean, for us, focusing on conservatorship rather than resources is a big mistake. Like you just mentioned, you know, the number of beds that are available drop by a third. And we have 1 million people in this city. How do you expect to accommodate those people that you can serve with those number of beds? Mm-hmm. And people who are already seeking voluntary services first aren't even getting those resources. Like Lisa Sun mentioned, going to Kaiser and not being able to access that service – That to me becomes a big issue. And so conservatorship is not the solution here. It's more resources. And I think there's a recent fight about the beds at the SF General where they tried closing down residential treatment beds, kicking out, 40 or 50 people who've been there for years on end who will eventually end up on the street, because that's what the statistics show.
Well, you know, there are so many police interactions with people who are suffering from mental illness. For those who make the argument that conservatorship, at the very least, puts that person on the local radar as someone who is mentally ill and not necessarily an issue for police, is there not any upside, Lisa Sun Gresham, in having this program so that this person is if they're too mentally ill to deal with their problem, that they are literally conserved?
So for me, it's not even so when we think about, let's say you have a person who has mental health challenges on the street, and they happen to be in one section of the neighborhood, and someone says, I don't like this person on the street, so I'm going to call the police and have them do what amounts to a wellness check. They don't know that's what it's called, but really they're just trying to get rid of that person off their street. The thing that people don't understand about if you get pulled up and taken by the police to the hospital, when they do an analysis of whether or not someone needs to stay for 5150, which is an involuntary hold, even if the physicians there decide, this person doesn't meet the qualifications, right? They're not so ill that they need to be here and that I need to lock them up. That even though they're not actually being held, that one marks against them against the eight.
Even
if they're not actually held and treated and provided services and support, which is the idea of a 5150, is to get them nice and stable, talk to them, see what's going on, do sort of a diagnosis, and then move forward with the treatment of their choice, theoretically. But if you aren't actually being supported and taken in, you know, in that sort of warm embrace, but then you're just bumped right back onto the street, you could have the same person being called on by the police three or four times in the same day in different neighborhoods of the city. And if you're not careful, then we have a situation where the police may inadvertently, not even willingly, put someone in a position where they've eaten up all of their eight, and now their rights are forfeit. So to me, it's not necessarily about letting your local police, who's theoretically supposed to protect and serve one's community, to let them know who's out on the street. You run the risk of stigma, inaction, and discrimination right there in front of you, and having your rights stripped when you didn't even receive the support you deserved.
Peter Murphy, for those people who are profoundly mentally ill, some of them, many of them homeless, and we see them on the streets, if not conservatorship, what are the alternatives for treatment? If they're a danger to themselves and society, what are the options?
Well, I feel like all of us agree that we're in a crisis here in San Francisco. I feel like even the title of our conference kind of addresses this, the idea of it's the system. Mm-hmm. And not the people. And, this is actually, I don't know how much time you want to spend on this today, but this measure that we're talking about, it's a statewide measure that counties around the state could opt to participate in. And I believe Los Angeles, San Diego, and San Francisco were considered for it. And San Francisco is the only one that's seriously considering it. And I don't know if that just speaks to the depth of the problem we have here. But our feeling is that if the system and the resources that we do have were better administered and organized, that we wouldn't have to go down this road. I think what I'm hearing as well, and I think it's a little bit confusing for people because there's a lot of legal issues here too. But it really feels like it sets a bad precedent for taking away the civil liberties of people in our society who we have conservatorship laws already in place. This just expands the definition to include people that have substance use issues and that are generally it's going to affect homeless people and those on the street. So I think all of us would really hope that we could make some really substantial changes to our system in order to help provide services. Because also, I think this is a little bit of a cosmetic kind of thing. Like these are folks who are probably the most demonstrably in need of help on the street. And essentially what we're but we're not really set up to care for them in a way. It's like we're not sure where they're going to go, you know, despite all the talk about that we're going to conserve them. So it's a complicated issue.
Why are we seeming to see more of this phenomenon, Lisa? Is it just our imagination, or are there fewer beds? Why is it that suddenly you're literally stepping over people who are clearly suffering from mental illness?
There are fewer beds, and there's inadequate support resources for the employees that are already in place. So, like, for example, like when we were Hummingbird, right? They were talking about removing some of the beds that were in the hospital, their reasoning was like they said, even though we have people that are here, we don't have system-wise the ability to provide the appropriate staff that has the level of training and stringent measures that are necessary. You have burnout for folks that are in the helping professions that are trying to do the work, and they themselves don't have enough resources to fill the internal well to then serve others. So it's over the past couple of years, you've seen a slow creeping reduction in beds, and then a lack of support for the employees that are working in the public mental health system, the clinicians, the interns, not getting what they need to feel like I can do this job to the best of my ability and really serve the people that I care about. And so you know, at the rally there were doctors and nurses out there saying, please don't do this. There are folks here that have lived in this community for 15 years. These are their people. And if you're to tell them you have 60 days to find new housing, that level of sort of catastrophic change to someone's world. What are you going to expect if you have no place for them to go? You don't offer them anywhere else to leave after you've asked them to vacate. And your reasoning is, we don't have appropriate resources for staff, so we'll just trim the beds and reallocate our resources elsewhere. That doesn't serve the folks that they feel that this is their community and their home. Mm-hmm. And now I say, too bad. Find a new home.
And it's not our imagination. We are actually seeing more, and there are structural reasons for that.
Yes.
Let's go to the phone. We have a caller from Lake Tahoe. Thank you so much for holding on. Go right ahead.
Very good. Thank you. First of all, can you hear me okay?
Sure can. Can you turn your radio down?
Oh, my radio's not on.
Okay, good.
Basically, I'll just say I am a person with bipolar 2 disorder. I have been this way since birth, but I didn't understand it until about 1994 after a divorce because I just talked too much. Anyway, here's the point. People with bipolar disorder, at least in my life, and I've known many people with this problem, may not understand that they have, I think, what you would call a disease of the brain. You know, it's no different than a disease of the liver or something like that. The brain is just another organ. But in any case, I am what you would call a high-functioning person with a mental disorder. It has actually served me well. I was a straight-A student all the way through high school. I got a degree in physics and music, and you go on from there. But anyway, in the real world, people like me, and I suppose I can speak for many people with bipolar disorder, that you're often a lot more engaged in your own experience of life, and you talk too much, and you want to teach everybody everything you've ever learned, and people just don't always want to be around such people. Anyway, I've spent over $8,000 on therapy just to try to make it more realistic to engage with other people. Beyond that, I finally found an excellent psychiatrist with Kaiser Permanente. I'm not advertising for them, but I found help, and I was able to get the help I needed just in terms of counseling. And beyond that, appropriate medications for my condition. And I had to pay for this, but I finally found a psychiatrist who diagnosed me appropriately and gave me the first medicine I've ever had that actually works for my bipolar condition.
That is excellent.
You're
one of the lucky ones.
I feel I'm one of the fortunate few. Mm-hmm. And it hurts me deeply that there are people who have to live on the street because they're just different than other people and they have no clue. And what can they do if they don't fit in? And anyway, I wound up, I don't want to go on and on, but I was given a medication that works for me, mm-hmm. and it's just for me. Everybody's different. Everybody. And everybody has their own quirks, and some people have serious schizophrenia and whatnot. Bipolar is not schizophrenia, but in any event, I was prescribed lamotrigine, which is a bipolar antidepressant that works for me, anyway, and another one that helps me sleep, because my official diagnosis is bipolar 2 disorder with severe insomnia, and that often goes with it. So I've been prescribed, a second medication. Its name is gabapentin.
Oh, yes, and I've heard of that.
And a lot of people use it. And at a sufficient dose, it helps me sleep. And with enough sleep, you know, you can more or less be normal. Anyway, treatment is available, but you have to ask for it. Sometimes you have to pay for it. And God bless those people in San Francisco. And I just love the warm line. It's a wonderful idea to help people who, you know, oftentimes are born that way.
Absolutely.
And treatment makes a huge difference. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you for your show. I'm a sustaining member, and I just love listening to KLW. Thank you so much.
Thanks, GS.
Alrighty.
Calling all the way from South Lake Tahoe. Thank you so much. That's a success story, and I know those are good to hear. And, Peter, what are your thoughts about the fact that this person happened to have the $8,000 and the tenacity to just keep trying? How rare is that?
I congratulate the caller. I mean, it's great that they had the resources to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would probably just add too, and I think we might have referenced this earlier, but like something like the Warm Line, it's a service that can be there, say when somebody's isn't able to reach their therapist or their counselor, and can be a great support that way. But it sounds like for this person, yeah, a lot of it is being tenacious and hanging in there to find what works for you. So,
but isn't it ironic when you're probably at the lowest ebb is when you've got to be
exactly.
a really fierce advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about the financial component to mental health care, which was something GS talked about. It still is a major challenge. So many people would go to therapy if therapists weren't charging $150 an hour. So maybe, Mark, you can talk about how community health care organizations are trying to replace a therapist or a psychologist or someone who can help them, but do so affordably.
Yeah. We're not saying necessarily replace, but an additional tool and resource for people. So our Warm Line, you know, we don't say we're therapists or psychologists or anything of that nature. We're a tool for peer counseling, and you can call us when you do need that extra support.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, seeing a therapist is $100, $150 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the middle class these days is kind of been dwindling, and affording that, choosing, you know, your therapist and medication versus choosing what to eat the next few weeks or so.
Or to pay your rent.
Or pay your rent, mm-hmm. or pay utilities is a very difficult choice. And, you know, feeding your kids mm-hmm. is probably the most important thing, or mm-hmm. feeding yourself. So having to make that choice is really difficult. And so the affordability is another big barrier for accessing mental health services, not only in San Francisco, but anywhere else. I've seen so many articles where families could not afford the $150 once a week just to see a therapist. And so these socioeconomic barriers are really hindering people from accessing support. And that's why we see an uptick in terms of the number of people you see on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't fully recovered from the recession, and they haven't found a job that allows them to get these accesses. Even when you have access to services or the insurance plans, like Mr. Sun was saying, Kaiser is having a difficult time. As you know, Kaiser psychiatrists went on strike about 6 or 7 weeks ago because there were not enough psychologists to provide therapy and treatment for their own clinics. So,
well, part of the problem is my guess too, is that mental health doesn't seem to be fully integrated into primary health care and generalized health care in general. So it somehow sits outside.
And that's one of the biggest things that we're tackling. It's a systematic thing. Mm-hmm. We like to say that you should equate mental health to like physical health. You know, it's like a broken leg that you have to treat and care for, and you need support on it. It's this whole person approach. What's funny is that the whole health system is talking about person-centered integration and wellness. Then they go, mental health is right there on the mm-hmm. side. Why is that not part of a component as someone's whole treatment as they move forward from any type of physical or mental health issue?
You'd think we'd be more enlightened by now, wouldn't you?
We hope so, but here we are.
Let's go to another caller, Erin in San Francisco. Thanks for holding. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was wondering how someone could volunteer to be a peer and answer phones.
Who wants to take that one? Peter?
Well, the best thing to do would be to go to our website. Actually, right now, because of our funding, and we're really happy that we're able to pay our counselors for their work. So we're not using volunteers right now. But if you go to our website, which is mentalhealthsf.org, there is a way to volunteer on there to help with at the agency in general.
Thank you, Erin. You know, there are lots of technological approaches now that people have that they didn't used to have. Apps like Talkspace and Hack Mental Health, so that, you know, there are more entrees, more on-ramps to help than there used to be. But I thought it was interesting that one of the modules in the conference is discussing the environmental causes of mental health issues, specifically for communities, poor communities that are disproportionately affected maybe by air pollution. And I'm wondering, maybe you can discuss either Peter or Mark or Lisa, and if you have any insights on what they are now finding is a correlation between environmental issues and mental health.
Yeah, I mean, I can talk to that to the lens mm-hmm. of population health, mm-hmm. right? Economic factors, health behaviors, all play a part into someone's psychological state. So if you're always constantly stressed about looking for food, looking for someplace to live, that will take a toll. Eventually, you know, it will trigger some mental health challenges for you. I mean, that's almost a guarantee. So living in constant stress or living in an environment where it's physically not conducive to a healthy lifestyle. So imagine you are an individual living in an area where you live right next to the freeway and you constantly hear cars. You never hear a sense of silence. That kind of sound can really affect someone's mental health. So there's so many factors. We call it a paradox. It's a paradox of things. Mm-hmm. It's not just one thing. It's an integrated interplay of one another that will really truly define what your psychological state is. And so population health issues like that are that's why we kind of support integrating mental health into this whole system. And I think one of the greatest things that's on the initiative right now is the Mental Health SF initiative, the Mental Health Access, or Mental Health SF, coincidentally with our name, mm-hmm. Providing mental health access to all San Franciscans, no matter where you are in the economic scale. Mm-hmm. You can just walk in, get services for the time being until you're able to find a permanent solution to services.
It seems like such an enlightened approach. And you mentioned, I think it's interesting that, as you said, there might be people who have slid into a mental health condition based on circumstances like having lost a job, like having lost their home, like having been foreclosed on, like having declared bankruptcy. The stress, just the stress alone, can send someone who is otherwise healthy and had been all their lives into a slide. And who can't relate to that, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Peter?
I was just going to say that we're looking forward to the conference, like we've mentioned, mm-hmm. as an opportunity to discuss a lot of these different possibilities and solutions as well. So just want to encourage folks to, they could go to our website again, mentalhealthsf.org. to find out information about the conference, Redefining Crazy, It's the System, Not the People, which will be November 6th and 7th.
I love that title. Again, it's not the people that are crazy, it's the system.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly it.
Okay. And so let's just kind of do one quick round robin as we start to wind up. Mark, what are the solutions for better mental health care going forward? And what do you hope that this upcoming conference offers?
For me, it's just giving access. So a lot of people, again, economically can't even access services. And then when you access services, providing high-quality services. But then having the courage to actually get to that door, making that phone call is also another thing. So we should really talk about stigma and how our society really talks about mental health. Because immediately when you say mental health, they usually associate with violence, which is statistically wrong. People are with mental health issues are usually the victims of violence more than anything. And so, you know, access, stigma, this whole systematic structure, and that's why we called it. Let's really define crazy. What is crazy is the fact that, you know, when somebody does something over and over again and expect different outcome, we say that's crazy. Mm-hmm. So why do we live in a system where we do the same thing over and over again and then say, hey, why are you on the streets now? Why are you homeless? Why do you have mental health issues? Now we need to conserve you. We're like, well, why don't you help create a system that actually supports that individual?
So. Sounds like that's kind of the way we're moving. I know San Francisco tends to be much more progressive than other places. But, again, with the round robin, Lisa, what are your solutions and what do you hope the conference offers with about 2 minutes left?
Oh, so what I hope the conference offers is especially one of our tracks is mental health at work. And Kristen Dempsey, our licensed clinician who also identifies as a peer, is doing a presentation on peers in graduate school and the idea of folks who carry an identity of peerness, of recovery and having been part of that community, then choosing to go into clinical work and getting their licensed MFT or their LPCC and the struggles and achievements and challenges that people can have while maintaining a sense of your peerness and your lived experience while also wanting to have that level of academic training. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to offer that information and to see what she has gleaned from that perspective.
Peter, you have been so valuable with about less than a minute to go. Your thoughts on the conference?
I just want to mention a couple things that we haven't talked about with the conference. Actually, we have had the conference before to focus on hoarding and cluttering, which is also an issue that's very highly stigmatized, and there's going to be a big part of that as well. Mm-hmm. And we're interested in reaching out to communities, like especially communities of color, to be sure that, you know, there's a lot of cultural stigma around mental health, too. So I really appreciate this opportunity, Renee.
Excellent. Peter Murphy, Lisa Sun Gresham, and Mark Salazar, the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. That conference, again, November 6th and 7th. And you can go to our website for more information. Your call is produced at KALW. Leah Cesreen is our producer, and Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's your call.